Greg, welcome to Parallax Podcasts. I contacted you because I wanted to talk about your new book. I have a beat up copy of it, which I've kept in my bag and have been going through. Oh, and I also wanted to say that we have a reading group where we're going through your book, and we've got to the first few pages or the first sections of the book, which are warnings. A great part of the book is a kind of a warning, and then you get into the nine spheres teachings. So I was thinking today, it was very funny how in the beginning of your book, you say, you know, don't read this book. It's a dangerous book, you know, stay the hell away. And then now that you've ignored the warning, enjoy the wondrousness of this book, a revelation of wonderment. So maybe that's my first question. Why the warning, and what is the warning all about reading this book? Why should we be careful about reading your book?
Well, thank you for having me on your podcast, Andrew. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. So the warning, I know many people find it kind of humorous or feel like, why is this included? Or like, is this really necessary? Or like, this seems like really over dramatic. And like, but the fact of the matter is, like, I'm 100% serious with this, because authentic spirituality is not a hobby or some sort of personal development project. It is a all-consuming fire that will destroy whatever notions you have of your life or yourself. And it doesn't really care how that happens or how you react to it. Because the truth of the matter is that reality abides our delusion, but it doesn't care that we live out the delusion. So if we try to break free from it, we're going to discover exactly how deluded we are and can be. And that is a truly dangerous endeavor, because our delusion is who we are, and it is the world that we inhabit. And so if one attempts to undo that, then there are no real supports other than the divine itself. And that is a terrifying prospect. But the prospect of then living in delusion, knowing the truth, is equally, I think, terrifying. So once you understand what's being communicated in the book at a fundamental level, then you can't go back. Right? It's like the Matrix. Like, you want to take the blue pill and go back in, but there's, you can't do it anymore. There's no going back. You can either go forward and accept what is being said and then change your life entirely to be in accord with that, or you can pretend that it's not really true and that it's just an interesting set of things to consider, but I'm not going to change my life. And then you end up sort of knowing that it could all be different, but you're not willing to take the steps necessary to actually live that, which is horrible. So the warning's real, and I feel like it's completely legitimate. And I understand people might feel like it's over dramatic or unnecessary or over the top, or like but in my mind is completely true and completely necessary. And I hope that there are people out there who read that warning and like, you know what? I'm putting this book down and I'm not going to read it because it's,
I don't think
not,
that will
it's
happen,
not really
Greg.
Worth it.
Do you think people will actually, that will actually happen? I think when
probably
somebody
not.
picked up a book like this, they're going to read it, you know?
Yeah. Well, then at least they've been warned.
At least they've been warned. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I don't know. People might find me a little intense in this regard, but I feel like these things are, like, we can joke about them and have good humor about it and you know, sort of a gallows humor about the situation, but it's totally serious and it's completely terrifying.
A gallows humor. Yeah. So what is it about you that does take it seriously? Like, what happened to you to make you a serious practitioner?
I think it was a number of things. I mean, probably the first thing is like the thing I describe in the first page of the book, where I was 5 years old and just looking up at the stars and completely overcome by the sense of wonder and awe and knowing that somehow this vastness was directly related to whatever small thing that I was, and was actually able to perceive it, and that there was some connection there that was super mysterious that just drew me in and never let me go. Just always wondering, you know, who am I? What is this place? Like, there's got to be some real purpose, or it can't just be random, meaningless, or have no intention behind it. And then I think sort of growing up and then training for my bar mitzvah was super intense, like exposure to prayer and like serious spiritual practice and like doing that for like hours every day for a year definitely changed me and made me. But to be honest, like I think I've always just been this intense. I don't know if it's something from somewhere else or some other time, or but I always felt like this is the only thing that really matters.
So the only thing that really matters, maybe we can jump in and talk a little bit about the nine spheres. And I had a question about that. I know there are Dzogchen teaching, but I don't know where they come from. I know that Traktam Kepa teaches the nine spheres and has been teaching them for the past few years. And I wonder if they have an origin, or they're his particular teaching or interpretation. What do you know about, what are the origins of the nine spheres?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting question because, like, if it's a fundamental teaching on the nature and essence of reality, like, it can't actually have an origin because it is reality itself on some level. But we could ask, like, who's the first teacher that expounded this teaching? And, you know, I don't actually know the answer to that. I mean, I know Longchenpa has teachings that concern this topic that have been written about. And I don't believe that it's, you know, but I think the thing is really, though, it's like what Traktam Rinpoche says, like, wisdom is never self-originated. So there isn't really an origin point as a being who is responsible for the teaching on that level. Like, so the question would be more like, is it a fundamental teaching on the essence of nature of reality? And it is. So then it's just simply something that practitioners have the possibility of discovering each for themselves. Mm-hmm. And then it would be self-evident. So I guess that's my real response to the question. Because I don't actually know, like, who actually first taught it, or when it was first written down, what book, and when that was published or disseminated. I don't have any idea.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that some people in the reading group were asking when we read it was, you know, it's considered to be a teaching about reality, about the ultimate reality. And then quote unquote, the highest teachings of the Buddhist path, and then maybe pre-Buddhist, or if it's just about reality, just saying it's Buddhist, is a bit of a misnomer as well. And if it's the ultimate teachings, you know, you can only really know this stuff through transmission from a teacher. And then, so why do we read about it? Why do we intellectualize about it? Like, how do we approach this teaching, you know, just reading the book?
That's a good question. Because, I mean, it takes into account the fundamental problems in trying to appreciate it from the level of a human being. So I guess my answer is that if we want to know about reality, we have to start somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. We can't simply, I mean, we could simply just drop into it, and by abandoning our identity and concepts and stories and whatnot, but that's much harder to do than it is to say. So if we start with where we are rather than where we would like to be or think we should be, then this is where we start, is with verbal descriptions and some diagrams and some stories and sort of like the rough sketching, you know, that language allows for in terms of trying to articulate these ideas, which fundamentally transcend language altogether. So it's an effort to meet us where we're at, and then it's up to us to then it sort of like digest it, chew on it, like consider it, think about it, and then, you know, maybe try to incorporate it into practice, into our own view of what all this is and what we are and how those things fit together or not.
Mm-hmm. So let's kind of talk about the nine spheres. You know, why are they spheres? Why are there nine of them? What are these nine spheres exactly?
So spheres, because they are aspects or dynamics of divinity. So a sphere is like a perfect shape because it has no edges or angles or sharp points. So it's considered sort of analogous to the divine, sort of like this idea of eternity or an infinity, because there's the angles are so infinite that it just forms a perfect sphere, and no actual point or angle can be discerned at all. And I know this has a history, in at least in the West, and I'm sure the world over, of sort of like describing the divine as a circle or a sphere. And so nine, because these are the nine dynamics that have been discovered in meditation as this sort of fundamental dynamics of reality. But I also feel on some level like 9 is a crucial number because it's a magical number, you know, simply from the mathematical nature of it and the way that it functions. But it also allows for this sort of 3x3 grid portrayal of this these dynamics. And I feel like on a sort of like a geometrical, magical level, that is really interesting, especially considering, like, from a Western context, this like magic squares, like the magic square of Saturn, which sort of in many ways kind of defines the limits of form and like our conceptual 3D space of the, you know, the solar system or the cosmos, if you will. So it feels on some level like a gateway into the nothingness or the divine or the emptiness or whatever term you want to use, the Ein Sof, whatever. So it feels like on that level, like this, the 9 spheres is that. And so they are 9 dynamics, and we could call them openness, disclosure, resonance, purity, spontaneity, pervasiveness, emptying, radiance, and a bright knowingness or awareness or awaring. So these dynamics are always interacting as a whole, but it's prior to appearance or consciousness or beings or realms or any of that. This is sort of the beginningless beginning of what is and what is not. So it's really beyond thingness altogether.
Do you think it's worthwhile to go through them a little bit and give people a bit of a feel for them? Like, the first one was called Nugbo, openness.
Openness. Uh-huh. So that's like a absence of thingness, a vastness. It's empty of all that we could know or that could be known, but it's not like a blankness, like a void.
It's not a mere nothingness. It's emptiness, or it's nothingness, luminosity.
It's really, I mean, as best I could describe, it's really like an absence of beingness, mm-hmm. really. Because it doesn't deny appearance, it just denies things or beings or consciousness or concept. So yeah, it's something that can be known in meditation, but it can't be known by a being in the way that we know things that are objects, if you will, because it's not an object in consciousness. It's sort of the absence of all objects. And when we, if we can sort of go into that nothingness in meditation, then we can't bring, like, I can't bring myself into that as an experience, because it precludes the being that I know is myself. So it's not a something that we can intellectualize and understand. It's more something that we can accept that we can't know as ourselves. But it can be known to itself through us by submitting ourselves to it, in a sense. I don't know if that makes sense from what you've read in the book and what I'm saying here.
Yeah, it's, well, I'm feeling the awkwardness of words and the pretentiousness of words when it is supposed to be an experience, and also the paradox of the fact that we're speaking in words. But I guess there's a sense of it or something like that. But then again, I would even question that.
I would question that too. I mean, I feel like really what we can know is sort of the implications of it.
Right, the implications. That's good.
Which is like, we perceive appearances, but we know that they all sort of arise from this open, empty nothingness, mm-hmm. including us. So that part of that, I feel like, is like we can't continue to kind of see ourselves and the story of us and who and what we are in the same way. Because we have a tendency to think like, well, I'm Greg and my mother and father are the origin of me, and like I've got this whole story of my life and what I've done and things I've experienced. But if we then actually can know that our real origin is this nothingness, emptiness, openness, and we're sort of arising within that in every moment, you can't continue to really like assign like a truth value of 100% to this other story of like, I'm a human being who was born from these two other beings and I've got this story of my life, because it's literally arising and dissolving like so fast in every moment that you can't actually account for like that. There's no like actual continuity in that story, mm-hmm. in the way that we imagine there is. So then we say, well, what is really going on here? And then you see, well, I'm just arising and dissolving from nothingness over and over and over and over again, like continuously. So that is like such a radically different take on what's happening that it kind of like completely blows the other one out. Not that you like don't like honor your parents or remember the events of your life. It's just that the meaning of it changes completely. And it doesn't become less meaningful. It actually becomes more meaningful, I think, if that's possible.
So what about the next one, Rang Xing? Can I go in order? What's the best way to look at these?
I don't know that there is a best way. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I guess I feel like to really understand these dynamics, it's necessary to like understand the entire context of the beginning of the book about like, what is the teaching? What is real? What are the different ways of knowing?
Okay.
You know, kind of, why is rationality like not the way to understand? What's the original situation versus the problem situation? Sort of like trying to understand that like this is reality, but not from a human being perspective. Because otherwise, I feel like just jumping into the nine spheres is like, it's just information and it doesn't really mean anything to anyone.
Okay. Well, what about if we do that, we talk about the path, let's say, you know, and the tantric path, and then, you know, leading up to the tantric path, and the ground of what needs to be established before we go into these wondrous realms of spheres.
So, like, the path would be basically like trying to see that there's like an original situation, which is gnosis or enlightenment or Buddha nature, and then that there's a problem situation, which is what we are, because we interpret perception in a way where we're a subject in a world of separate objects. And so really it's beginning with, like, you know, what is the original situation? Why is that? Like, what is that? And why is it that we are not that? And understanding that trying to become a being that doesn't perceive separation, that perceives themselves as part of a larger whole, can remedy like all of our feelings of like alienation and separation and suffering, and thinking that somehow we can make life as a human being work in the way that we think we can, or that we think we're supposed to somehow. So it's kind of like a coming to grips with the fact that mostly human beings don't know what makes us happy, and that we have to then sort of submit to teachings or a teacher that actually understands what reality is, not from an intellectual point of view, but from a lived experience point of view. So then it becomes a question of like the teacher or the guru or the spiritual master, and then learning from them, working with them or for them, and trying to embody the teachings, like to basically to change the way that we are to be in accord with reality rather than our own tendencies or habits or ways that we prefer to be. And so there's a struggle to sort of understand like what is real in from that context, because we think, well, if it's physically existent, it's real. Or, you know, if I can somehow know it or understand it, then it's real. But this path says that there's only really divinity is the only thing that's real. And it's not a thing. It's more better described as no thing or nothing. And that what is real is not personal. Like whatever is real can't be something that only you know or experience or can be, that it's available for all at any time, anywhere, you know, in any realm, whoever they are, whatever they are. And so that's just really the divine is only that. So then we have to sort of like adjust our focus from sort of self-centeredness.
All right. We're not sure where I was there.
I think you were talking about submission in a way. You were talking about submission to the divine, and this, you know, fact that we need, that was what I was hearing, that there's some submission that is necessary.
So within that submission, there's like also an understanding or coming to understand that the way that we think, reason, is good for certain things that we need to do, but it's not effective or useful when it comes to trying to understand spiritual teachings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, relative truths.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. there are different sorts of truths. There's different ways of knowing. And so if we, when we are trying to approach like a higher level of truth, well, like relative truth would be like what's true for us as human beings, mm-hmm. which is a vast amount of information and fact. But then there's higher levels of truth, like an absolute truth. And that requires a way of knowing that doesn't see polarities or dualities. Instead, it sees complementarities.
Yeah.
It sees more wholeness than it does thingness.
Yeah, I like the way you put that as complementarities, because often people focus on non-duality as being, but complementarity seems to be important.
Yeah, because there can be difference and distinction and still be wholeness. I mean, that's what reality is.
And there's an ecstatic, that's the ecstatic aspect.
Yeah, that's an sort of an ecstatic way of knowing, because when one is in the state, it's not static, it's ecstatic. So we can understand that both from the sort of like feeling perspective of like blissful, but also from the perspective of like not standing still or not mm-hmm. like being stuck. Mm-hmm. It's very fluid. And so from that, that's the sort of level we're trying to approach these teachings from. And so we have to then, on some level, abandon their sort of human reasoning that would say the mind and thinking and consideration will help us to become enlightened or see through our delusion, because the delusion is that the delusion is thinking and believing that thought is the way to transcend our mistaken interpretation of perception.
This is very bad news for my philosopher friends, I think. Yeah.
And it's not to say that there's no value in trying.
Yeah.
There is. It's just the value, I feel like the ultimate value would be like an exhaustion of it. So one comes to the point where one tries it so hard that then the mind just is exhausted and drops it completely, and they're like suddenly in a moment of naked awareness.
Isn't that what Nargajuana did? He deconstructed everything and then discovered the tantric path in a way.
Maybe.
Something like that.
So it's not that it's useless, it's just that it can't be the actual method that's reliable.
Mm-hmm.
It can be useful. It can be a good way to understand and learn our limitations, as well as the true, like, amazing nature of the mind to be able to know. But ultimately, it should lead one to the understanding that there is so much more that can be known beyond thought, that thought becomes like nothing, like in comparison. So I don't, yeah, I feel like, and I feel like there's probably other ways of sort of consideration or contemplation about this that are a little less traditional than an academic sort of approach that would be like the way that Nisargadatta kind of talks about like putting your attention on the I am and sort of like using that as the doorway to see through it.
Well, you're
And
sort of using the using like the transform the poison or the delusion to make it transparent or something like that.
yeah, eventually, like the mind has to see through the mind because that's really what's going on here. Because we're trying to perceive the very thing that is perceiving. So, how does one do that? Well, there's all kinds of methods, but ultimately, you have to figure out how to do it for yourself as best you can, hopefully, with the help of a teacher who's done it themselves and knows how to teach you to do it, but it's still, there's still a large part that's on the practitioner to do the work and to figure it out.
So this movement, like from relative to absolute to ultimate truth, maybe you want to speak about that. How is absolute and ultimate? Like, is this the same movement as, let's say, the Sutric path, which, works on our mundane life, prepare us for the more tantric teachings, which works with the static complementarities, and then there's something beyond that, even the ultimate.
Yes, well, it's sort of like the ecstatic way of knowing this absolute truth that can be spoken of, written about, discussed, told stories about, but this sort of absolute, ultimate truth. That's where silence knows mystery. So there's really no language or symbol or diagram or communication that can actually take place because that is a knowingness that is so far beyond beingness that no language is even possible. And I don't know that there's a way to get there. There's certainly, it can be arrived at, but I couldn't tell you how. Because even though I might have been in that state, like I don't believe that I could explain how that even happened or what that was.
So, like, the view of the book, or the view, let's say, is that you practice the tantric practices, the many practices, right, with a Dzogchen view, but you can't actually practice Dzogchen because it's just reality itself. But then there are practices which are Dzogchen. So I'm a bit confused about that, about the practices that are Dzogchen and the practices that are tantric and
Well, the book is describing a view that is from Dzogchen teachings. And that's the view that we hold, and that's the view that we practice. But the actual methods, the meditation methods, are tantric methods. So they're not Dzogchen methods. And it's just really a difference in like what the practice is versus the view of reality that one has when they're doing the practice or living their life or whatever. So it's just really a distinction in view, trying to hold this ultimate view of reality and practice all the different levels of the path. Because reality is reality. The view of reality may be different at different levels or stages, but if reality is truly what it is, like, it doesn't change based on us.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to hold the view of reality as it actually is, even if we can't perceive that or don't know that. Because if we hope to arrive at that, we need to prepare sort of the ground, you know, and that's why this sort of like analogy with the tree and the flower and the fruit and sort of like, you know, all of this sort of functions together. If we don't know what reality is and don't try to hold that view and practice that, like when we arrive at it, like it's difficult to know what it is we're coming to because it is so different and so radical than what we typically interpret perception as.
Hmm. Yeah. I think Rinpoche said in a recent talk that most of the path is it's an efficacious lie, in a sense. It's useful to us only because we are deluded in some kind of a way.
Yeah, it's useful because we can't actually know or have real control over our minds, which then prevents us from even being able to know what's really happening to us, with us, what we are, why we are.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we can't know that, then there's no way to really function properly and do what we're supposed to be doing. So it all functions as a whole when it's engaged together. And yes, it kind of has to be this sort of efficacious lie because we have to start where we are. And where we are is a lie because we lie about what we are and who we are to ourselves in every moment. So we have to use some other lies to try to like see through these original lies that we tell ourselves about who and what we are. And then if we are able to sort of be flexible enough to manage that, then there's some hope that we can eventually kind of see through all of it.
So have we covered, let's say, a little bit of, let's say, the introduction?
Yeah, I think we have.
And I apologize for jumping too quickly into it.
No, that's no reason to apologize. I feel like that's generally, again, like with the introduction and the warnings, people are like, well, why do I need all of this like background material? Why can't we just talk about the nine spheres? Like, why the holdup? Why all this?
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing. It's like if you try to just jump into the nine spheres, it's just going to be some information about some words, and like that's not going to do anything for anyone really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if you have some context and some understanding about like what it is and like why we're talking about it and why it's important to understand it, even if we can't know it directly or practice it, like, then it might have some impact beyond just some informational entertainment.
Yeah, I guess there is a beauty to when you read about it as well as, I guess there is a way in which we want to be entertained at the same time. So
I guess that's
a confession of mine. I guess I want to be entertained by you, Greg, a little bit. But I guess it's, and I appreciate the fact that you're bringing the gravitas of it so that I don't get carried away here.
Well, it's interesting because I remember like someone I had read the book was like, you know, this section you put in about like we don't want to learn about this material to like for some sort of self-aggrandizing purpose, to know more than others, to sort of just be entertained or whatever. Like, and she was like horrified, like, why would you think anyone would read it for that purpose? And I'm like, because I know me, I know myself, and yeah. I know that I would, if I came across a book like this, it's exactly why I would read it. And so, yeah, it's kind of trying to emphasize like, yes, it might be interesting. It might be cool to know it. It might be like super kind of fun to consider it. But that the whole purpose is really to like know it so that we can then become it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not really to know more than others or feel superior or be entertained or interested or whatever. It's really like there is a mostly unconscious and unspoken sort of bargain that goes into one understanding material of this nature, because mm-hmm. if one actually understands it truly, then one is obligated to then live out the implications of it. And I feel like if one truly understood it and didn't do that, they would be on some level cursed.
That's pretty strong. Yeah.
And I don't mean that in like someone's going to put a curse on you, but like to know the truth and not actually live it out or even be capable of it would be a horrible, horrible thing to have hanging over you all the time, when it would be so much easier, not easy ultimately, but easier than like living with that kind of willful ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I remember when I was much younger, I'd spent a bunch of time reading the works of Nisargadatta Maharaj, and he only teaches the ultimate truth, you know, that's all he teaches. And then I remember getting very high on those teachings on some level. And then I went back into the, after living in a monastery for a year, and then I went back into the world, and I could hardly function as a human being. Like I was completely out of it. And what do I want to say is, I want to say like these sort of ultimate teachings, you know, there's a path too, right? There's a path too that we have to kind of work through in order to become fully human so that we can handle this kind of stuff, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely necessary to become a functional human being first. And then to try to work on the methods of the path, because I think the methods are intense and difficult enough, and the path itself, like relating to the spiritual master and following instructions, and like it's incredibly challenging and very difficult, and it requires some equanimity and some poise and some real perseverance and the ability to sort of be resilient. And so we have to really make ourselves into vessels that are able to hold the blessings that this sort of thing entails. And so it is it requires a lot of background and a lot of work and a lot of patience with ourselves and others. It does.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I'm sort of hesitating here, in terms of the next part of the book, you know, which is so first we have Dzogchen for view, Vajrayana for practice. We've kind of gone through that a little bit, I think, and reality from its own perspective.
That's,
is there anything to say here, or have we?
I think we've kind of covered it. It's just really sort of understanding that this is. This is a view of reality from its own perspective, not from a human perspective, and the understanding that those are vastly different perspectives. And if we want to understand reality, we have to try to abandon our own narrow, limited perspective, at least temporarily. And I feel like that is a good sort of lead up into trying to understand the sort of no-woe, openness, emptiness, nothingness, which is really the first sphere, which also really encompasses all of these dynamics all together. Because if we think about the fundamental, you know, essence of it, it is this sort of nothingness.
And this one sphere sort of, in a way, they all contain each other, right? They're completely a fractal arrangement, or in a sense. Would you say that's
correct? I would say if we had to, like, think about it in an arrangement, like, you could say, like, no, this no-woe, the nothingness sphere would contain everything, because everything is contained in nothingness, emptiness, and arises from it. So it is sort of like the ultimate container.
Mm-hmm. And then we have these Tibetan terms like Ragzin, Tugje, Kadak, and then there's various translations in the book, and they're often very different. And I know that when Dr. Rinpoche teaches, he often changes the translation, and so that there's a quality that there's an infinite sort of there's no limit to what, like a musical scale or something like that. There's infinite variations in terms of how we could see these and the relationship that they have to each other.
Yeah, I mean, appearance is rich in variation and color and form and the overall feeling tone of it all. So it's like highly, highly variegated. And so language has similar qualities. And so the way of describing these dynamics can morph or change or show different aspects of itself in description. And that is, I think, nothing more than a reflection of how reality actually is. So it's sort of like its own descriptive display is nothing more than itself in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Can you say something about the word Rigpa? Because this is a word that's known, that people know about this word, and that's the, you know, that's the last one in the series of nine, so to speak.
Yes.
For some reason, I wanted to ask you about Rigpa.
Yeah, I think Rigpa is a kind of interesting one to think about. So generally translated as bright knowing or bright knowingness, it's sort of this aspect or dynamic of divinity that knows.
It's sometimes translated as gnosis as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, because gnosis is definitely like that sort of knowing. So this bright knowingness, it knows itself as itself. I think there is like the brightness or the luminosity that is the nature of reality has this quality of knowing. And I feel like on some level, like this is really like what we're trying to engage with when we are in meditation practice ultimately, right? Because we're like shaping light into the form of deity through our visualization. And because of the nature of reality, when we do this with discipline and authenticity and consistency and devotion, that something happens whereby this luminosity kind of like feels as if it's taking shape, like beyond our own capability or intention on some level. Like this is often described, I think, in teachings as the Samaya Sattva and the Jhana Sattva, you know, and so this brightness, this that knows, it is like, it is what we are trying to engage with. It is what is the stuff that reality is actually made of. And there are, I think, instances where one can directly encounter this sort of brightness, and that can inform you and help us to, as beings, to know things that we wouldn't be able to really understand or know otherwise, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a really mysterious thing to try to understand or perceive it from our perspective. Because I feel like on some level, it again requires us to fully embody like all of these things that we've been talking about up until this point.
Yeah.
And actually live that way. And that's truly, truly difficult. I try to do it and fail every day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, the warning label on the bottle. Yeah. What about the emergence? I think that was the second one. Is that's another one that kind of caught my attention.
Yeah.
About what that means, because emergence is a word that people use a lot these days. And what does it mean within the context of the nine spheres?
Well, it really means that the divine is always trying to tell you its secret, which is itself. It's always trying to show itself in every moment, in every appearance, even though we don't want to see it or can't see it, or even if we can see it, we don't think that's what it is, or don't take the message of it to heart. So it's constantly trying to show itself to us, and we are constantly trying to pretend we don't see it. So yeah, it's a disclosure, emergence, sort of a continuance of itself as trying to divulge itself, to sort of like let itself be known to itself, as itself, through itself. And I feel like on some level, for people who practice, who are, live this sort of life, they probably already, they know what I'm talking about already.
Yeah.
But I think for those that don't, it makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the whole thing doesn't make too much sense for those who don't, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll catch a glimpse of something here and there in this discussion. Hopefully it will be of value.
Hope so.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I'm looking at the English words, you know, resonance, purity. Spontaneity is in the center, which is Lundrup.
Yes.
What about that one? What about the center of the nine spheres? Why is spontaneity in the center of the nine spheres?
Yeah, it's interesting that sort of like the spontaneity is in the center, and it's sort of like a crux of it, that what appears doesn't actually have like a cause as we might believe or interpret that word. Because if there's only divinity, then what causes what? Right? So everything is spontaneously arising because there's no cause and effect ultimately in reality in the way that it is, you know, prior to beings and consciousness and realms and all of that. And so when one theoretically lives in that state, then it's all spontaneously arising, just itself, just the divine itself, and the divine itself perceiving itself arising as itself. And so it's all spontaneous, and it's all ultimately uncaused. And I think that's kind of a difficult thing to grapple with, because we live in the world of cause and effect, right? Everything we experience has a cause,
mm-hmm.
except for this.
Yeah. Would you say that this is post the notion of karma?
I think it's prior to the notion
of karma. Prior to the notion of karma, right.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there can only be karma when you have a being, right, who interprets their perception as being separate, right, where they have their own story that they live out, where their actions have consequences because they're not, you know, because they're an individuated being.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe this is really the tough thing for people to understand prior to being, this whole notion.
Yeah, because we don't know it. We can't experience it. And we can never say like, oh, I know what it means to be prior to being this, because we don't know what that means.
Yeah.
We can't know it. But there is a utility in accepting the fact that we don't know, we can't know, that we don't, like, we accept, like, I don't know, like, and I appreciate the fact that there are things I cannot know as me.
Mm-hmm. And yet we're declaring that this is true.
They can be known, but not by me.
And yet, like, we're declaring that this is true, which is very strange.
Well, we can declare it's true because of the lineage of teachings and teachers and methods. And if we rely on those, then we at least have some basis for it. if we accept that the guru is an authentic guru and is what they say they are, then, and we have faith in that, then we can say it's true.
Yeah. So it's always
for someone who doesn't have that faith or know that, they could not say this is true.
Mm-hmm, right.
Nor should they.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because maybe sometimes we want to convince people of something, and that's probably a mistake.
Well, this is this again, if we think about what is real, what can only be known by some, that can't be real. Mm-hmm. It has to be available to all, anytime, any place, for it to be real in the sense that we're talking about.
I'm not sure I understand the jump from what I said to that.
Well, if we, the truth is accessible to all.
To all, yes.
But it's not actually known to all unless they make the journey. Mm-hmm. And so the ones that make the journey can say it's true as far as I know. And the ones that don't will never be able to say that. Even if they think it, they can't really know. Mm-hmm. But it is available to anybody, anytime, anywhere. But those that will actually find out are so few and far between that it's like...
Yeah, you mean it doesn't have to be a Buddhist path or a Sufi path or any particular path at all. It's just, it's there. And the sincere person who has the burning desire to know will find it.
I think that's true. The person who has the burning desire to know, who lives the question, they will... Like, if you seek, you will find. Like, that is the truth. If you knock, a door will be opened. It might not be the first door you knock at. It might take a long time. It might take years or lifetimes. But if you truly, like, make it your only concern, the only thing that matters to you, you will find it. As human beings, like, if we put our mind to something and dedicate our actions to it, like, we can do, if it's within our capability to do, we can do it. And I think someone who wants to discover reality, regardless of how they discover it, they'll find it. They will definitely find it. There's no doubt. Mm-hmm. Because it's not actually hiding from us. Right? Or if we think back to that Rongjin, this emergence disclosure, it's like it's trying to show itself to us. We're the ones who are hiding from it.
Why are we so stubborn? Why do we not hear the call? Why, you know?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I can remember the moment I asked Trakdon Rinpoche about this, like when I was talking earlier about this idea of the Samaya Sattva and the Jhana Sattva, and how we, when we visualize the deity, it's the Samaya Sattva, but we're trying to like call the wisdom being, the Jhana Sattva, into our visualization somehow. And like he's like, what are you talking about? He's like, the Jhana Sattva is like, it's like, it's just waiting for you. You're the one who's hiding all the time. Like, you think it's hiding from you, but you're the one hiding from it. Like, and he just like flips it so radically, like on its head, that then you see, like, yeah, I'm deluded because I don't even see what's going on here. And then once he describes it, it's like, oh, it's so obvious, but I couldn't actually know it until it's pointed out. And it's the same as this. Like, we think like, oh, discovering reality, encountering the divine, like what a momentous, miraculous, and it is momentous and miraculous, but it's not like it's inaccessible. it's actually like quite accessible, and we make ourselves inaccessible through our demands and preferences and wanting it to be this way or that way, or endless, you know, problems that we bring to the table that prevent us from actually living in like divine glory ultimately. And I say this as someone who is aware of my, like becoming more aware of my own tendencies and habits and problems that prevent me from doing exactly what I'm talking to you about. And it's incredibly frustrating. I think as you read at the end of the book here, this is it's infuriating on some level. It's ultimately like frustrating, and it hurts. And I feel like the greatest joy and the greatest frustration, like all in the same moment. Like, I know what it takes and I know what it is, but I can't actually be it yet. And that is horrible on some level. It's horrible. And yet it's truly beautiful. And so I live in the midst of these complementarities, which I thought were exclusively, you know, this or that, but it's not. It's both at the same time. And it's,
so the horror and the beauty arise sort of simultaneously, or
they're from the same source. They're from me, and I'm the horror and the beauty all at once. And if I don't work on trying to reconcile that, then what the hell am I doing? Same question goes for everyone else, because they're living it too. Maybe not, you know, in your face, but we're all living it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I wake up every day and make an effort and then say, oh, it's, you know, the effort is, you know, just not, I mean, that life is sort of draining away, and that the time is very precious, and God, how do I get on that horse, or the wind horse, so to speak?
Yeah, I pray every day that we all are able to rouse that and do what we need to do to make a difference, because it does require it every single day. Maybe, I don't know if you play music at the end of this, but that song, A Sweet Slip Away, is like, that's exactly what you were just describing. I feel like you should play that for everybody.
I'll do that, yeah. There's one part in the book, I can't remember if it was Kadek or Sala, where you were talking about how it brought you to tears. And I kind of wondered why that one brought you to tears and not the other one. I can't remember which part in the book that was.
Was it? I feel like it might have been in the Rigpa section.
Maybe that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I was doing a retreat and just had like a flash of brilliance. And I think it was just like, I don't even know if it was a second. It was like just a moment. And then it felt like all the doubts and the questions and like all of it just dissolved in that moment. And I knew that there was like nothing really else for me to do. I mean, yeah, I need to practice and work on this, but like in terms of like wondering, like, you know, should I do this or do that, or like all of it, like all of the wondering about life really kind of like just was gone, I think. And it was like profound, like silent, peaceful feeling of just like, okay, I know what I need to do. And it's pretty much just a couple things. And then there's really nothing else other than that. And so it like removed a lot of resistance that I was feeling about practice and the path and like the future and like all of the stories about who I am and what I want to do, and it just gone. And I don't know how that happened, but it was like I just knew in that moment, like everything I needed to know, and everything I didn't need to know just dissolved. And it doesn't really make any sense, but yeah, the divine can totally change your life, but you have to let it happen, which means you have to be open to what it wants instead of what you want, which isn't definitely not going to be the same things.
Yeah. Well, that's provocative and beautiful. And that's why I like talking to you, or I hope that some people can feel this provocation and maybe take up some of this in whatever way they can do that.
Yeah, it is really hard. But life is hard anyway, so we can try to make it meaningful and on some level, that's probably the best we can hope for. Like, that would be good enough. I'm not saying we should be satisfied or stop there, but like that in and of itself has got to be worth it.
I was thinking when you were speaking of in your book about the bells from Toph saying you don't have the right to be sad. I guess if you could understand that, maybe you don't have the right to be sad anymore. Does that make any sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it doesn't mean we won't feel sad.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to.
But it means we don't give ourselves permission to indulge in being sad and expressing that and bringing other people down or making them feel like they have to lift us up. Because if you're listening to this and you understand it and you have interest in this, that means you have an incredible life with great advantages and education and spare time and money and luxuries of modern life. And it also means you have the opportunity to actually do, like, live a life according to the spiritual path if you so choose. So there's nothing we've talked about today that anyone listening couldn't decide to do if they wanted. But again, it would be better to not start than to start and then not do it.
So is there, you know, that's, that's where we began this conversation. So
yes.
So perhaps we're heading towards the end of our conversation. So maybe Is there anything you want to say about your book, A Revelation of Wonderment? You know, and the subtitle is Reflection on Tractum Rinpoche's Nine Sphere Teachings from 2017 to 22. Is there anything maybe you want to say about the book, and then maybe what you want to say about what you're up to, or you know, in terms of other books that you're making or creating? Or
yeah, I mean, this book was incredibly challenging to write, because while I may intellectually understand the material, I do mm-hmm. not have any like lived experience of this.
It's challenging to talk about moments. Too, isn't it? Sorry, I interrupted you there, but it is. See, it does feel challenging to speak of this book as well.
It's challenging to speak of on one level because the material is so sacred that I hesitate to even articulate about it, because I feel like I'm not worthy. And on another level, it's hard to talk about, because the more that I consider what is actually the teachings here, the harder it is to even speak, because my mind just gets really quiet and it feels like my sentences start to just trail off, and like I don't know really what the actual point of it all is, right? Once you start to actually fully grasp like what's being said, then it just all starts to go very, very quiet. And so, yeah, it's difficult to talk about. It's difficult to write about. I don't really know how useful this may or may not be for anyone. I know for myself, it's been very, very beneficial, but it's also been difficult as hell, because it has helped me to see all the ways that I don't measure up or can't fulfill the real obligation that's required once you understand this all. And I'm working on it, but there's a level of frustration in just not being there. And then having to live in the increasing like nightmare aspects of my own life that, you know, I was perfectly content with before this, but now I see that they are like a complete horror show in regards to trying to, you know, actually live the teachings in the way that they're meant. And so it's just really, really, really challenging, and like constantly trying to like change and never being able to change enough fast enough to feel like I'm doing well. So it's hard. And so like all of the warnings I feel are completely legitimate, and I think I am somewhat shocked that other people on the path don't feel those kinds of like challenges or fears or the terror of it.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think like there's no way to relax in that, in like to fully relax, that I've been able to figure out. So it requires like, it feels like a real pressure cooker.
Yeah. Well, Greg, I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd say that all of this is beautiful and it's wonderful, and it does require us to like a certain level of sacrifice. And for those who are able and willing to do that, then they should do it. And those who don't want to do that, they shouldn't do it. And it'll be okay either way. But I appreciate you talking with me about the book, and I know it's a subject that is really a bit of a stretch for a lot of readers, and there's not a clear-cut benefit to like reading the book and like what you're going to get from it. And so anyone who reads it and considers it and is willing to talk with me about it, I'm like super happy about that, because even the people I love who are interested in these things don't really want to read the book or talk about it very much. So anyone who does, I'm really happy.
Oh, that's, well, that's good to hear. I mean, it's a beautiful book at the same time. So
yeah,
regardless of the gravity and the intensity and the struggle, it's also intensely beautiful, the whole thing. So again, that needs to be pointed out as well. So,
well, I'm glad you feel that way, because I really did pour my like all of myself into this book. There is nothing held back, really. So,
Well, thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate this opportunity. And if anyone feels moved to contact me after hearing this, they can find me at brothergreg@protonmail.com.
Okay, we'll put that in the in all the. Well, the on the links and etc.
Excellent. Well, I wish you a great rest of your day, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Yeah, I would love that. Yeah. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.